Welcome back to Cairo Nights. One of the issues that I've touched on from time to time on the show, broadly speaking, is criminal justice reform. We've talked a lot about that. Very specifically, bail reform and how it seems it disproportionately affects people who have done... I mean, if you're rich and you do a crime and you're poor, you do the same crime, one of you will stay in jail as a result, and one of you likely won't if you can actually make bail. And so there's been a rethinking of the need and necessity for bail in America. And it turns out Illinois just eliminated the requirement for cash bail. And it got me thinking, well, if Illinois is doing this, I can't imagine Washington is not also doing this. And so joining me right now on the show is Jamie Hawk. She's a legal strategy director for the ACLU's Smart Justice Campaign. Jamie, thank you for joining Cairo Nights.
Thank you for having me.
So what are we talking about regarding bail in Washington, and is there a move afoot to do something similar in bail? And then let's talk a little bit about, you know, what the studies have shown regarding bail. But first, let's talk about Washington and its bail system. What's going on with it right now?
Well, pretrial and bail reform has been a top criminal justice priority for the ACLU of Washington and many of our allies and other community organizations that we work with for several years now. And there's been quite a bit of work that has been underway, I would say, especially over the last 3 to 4 years, in the form of a statewide pretrial reform task force with judges and other county stakeholders. And there's been a bit of progress and work happening in several places around the state. And so, and as you point out, the recurrent money bail system is a wealth-based detention, that essentially does create two systems, one for folks who are wealthy and the other for the people living in poverty. And what we, so that, that truly does discriminate against those who are indigent, and also has significant racial disparities that are of great concern. And so, and one of the things that is important to note is that right now, when we think about our county jails statewide, and particularly right now due to COVID and the ongoing pandemic, the jail population consists of upwards of 80% of individuals who are pretrial. So this means they've not been convicted of a crime and they're simply waiting for their next court date. And so it creates a great deal of pressure on folks to plead guilty, to get out of jail. And of course, the harms of pretrial detention that individuals face. So you could lose your job, custody of your children, your housing, your medications get disrupted. So there's a great deal of harm that individuals face. And truly, this pretrial detention is a pipeline to mass incarceration, right, in light of some of the issues that I've highlighted. So there is a lot of work underway to address pretrial release issues and look at ways that we can reform our system here in Washington to support people to get back to court. Because really what bail is all about and what it's the intent of bail is supposed to be is to ensure that a person returns for their court date as ordered by the judge. And so there are a range of least restrictive methods of incentivizing appearance at trial and supporting individuals and, you know, and getting back to court. And so there's many ways that we can reduce the use of money bail statewide and address those goals.
We're talking with Jamie Hawk. She's the legal strategy director for the ACLU of Washington and its Smart Justice Campaign. You actually anticipated what one of my first questions was going to be, like, what is the purpose of bail? But really, what is the difference between people who post bail? I remember reading some study, I think out of maybe New Jersey, what the difference between people who post bail and their likelihood of coming back to trial, because that's the whole point of bail, and the people who actually aren't required to post bail. Is there a striking difference between who actually shows back up for their court date and who doesn't?
No. And there have been many studies to try to dig into this issue to see, you know, this notion of having financial skin in the game, or you having to actually pay money or go to a bail bonds company and have collateral for thousands of dollars, that being necessary, having some form of a secured bond to incentivize individuals to appear at court, and that just hasn't been the case. And as we know, there are so many individuals who don't have collateral. They can't afford. I mean, the vast majority of Americans in a crisis, you know, tapping their entire networks can't come up with even $400 to $500 to in an emergency to be able to pay a bond amount. So for the vast majority of Americans, any amount of $500 or higher is something that they just can't afford to pay. And so when we talk about that pressure to plead guilty, to avoid the harms of pretrial detention and to get out of jail, it's very very strong for so many people. So, but the studies, you know, many studies in various jurisdictions have shown that the imposition of money bail or a secured bond is not necessary. And, you know, for example, you know, looking at the federal system, so the federal system many years ago essentially eliminated the right to bail. And so I practiced as a federal public defender in the Eastern District of Washington for several years. And over a course of nearly 7 years, I never had to go to a bail bonds industry to pay a secure bond for my clients. So essentially what the courts use are unsecured bonds that, you know, don't require collateral or any payment of money to the court. And there is an unsecured bond that the individual signs. And then there are a set of conditions that are routinely imposed that the defendant is expected to follow. And there's, you know, pretrial services set up that kind of monitor that. And then individuals are essentially PR'd on their personal recognizance and released into the community while their cases are pending.
So let me actually create a comparison so I can build a clearer picture in my head. So at the federal level, when you were, certainly to use your example, Eastern District of Washington, if I am convicted, or rather I'm charged. Now, remember, this is, like you said, this is pretrial. I am charged with some level of fraud that gets to the federal level of fraud, as opposed to, let's just say, some sort of level of fraud that is the type of fraud that is just a superior court level of, that would be more of a state issue. In one of those situations, I might be required for X amount of bail. And then in the other one, I would not necessarily not be required for bail at the federal level. I would be required for essentially a bail system that is managed by the court. Could you explain?
So what happens, you know, at the federal level when there is a release or detention hearing by the magistrate judge? Is the court, there's a list of variables similar to how things operate for us now under Washington state law. So our Washington Supreme Court has approved a court rule. It's Criminal Rule 3.2, and that is the legal framework for pretrial release and detention decisions here in Washington State. So the judge is required to follow and consider a list of variables and factors about an individual defendant before and the presumption, based on the presumption of innocence, as we know, is a bedrock principle of our criminal legal system. Our court rule is based on a presumption of release. So because of that presumption of innocence, when you're merely accused of an offense, you should be released on your personal recognizance and without financial conditions of release that will result in people who are indigent not being able to pay them. So that is our legal framework now in Washington. And of course, the imposition of money bail is supposed to be the very last resort, the last consideration, because, and the court rule clearly states that the court shall consider the financial resources of the defendant. So really looking at an individualized ability to pay, you know, we don't want to impose amounts of bail that individuals have no means to pay. And so they're essentially being punished and held in jail before they're even convicted of a crime.
That makes some sense. We're talking with Jamie Hawk. She's a legal strategies director for the ACLU of Washington. It's Smart Justice Campaign. We're talking about bail reform. So what then in Washington State? It sounds to me like it's got a reasonably open system that can allow a judge to make that decision. Like, well, you don't have the financial resources. We are not going to require bail. Do we need to make any changes in Washington State?
Yeah, so we do, as you point out, we do have a strong court rule, actually, that other states and jurisdictions have looked to. And our Minority and Justice Commission of the Washington State Supreme Court made some important changes to our court rule several years back to incorporate some of the variables and criteria that judges are to consider. And so some of our work on behalf of the ACLU and many allies has been to have consistent implementation of this court rule statewide. And I think and part of what we've been pushing for and have shared with the state legislature in terms of what the role of the legislature can be is providing funding and resources to our counties to build least restrictive and community-based alternatives to incarceration. So we often talk about it as sort of pre-trial infrastructure for our state. And some counties have it. You know, they have some community-based programs or programs run by the county that support individuals when they're getting released from jail and help them get back to court as the judge has ordered. And some counties really don't have anything. And so some judges will tell you that they might not want to impose any money bail, but they feel like they don't have any other alternatives in the community or other programs that they can, require of individuals. So we've been looking a lot at those issues statewide, and even our state auditor did a helpful report in the last couple of years sort of evaluating pretrial services and some of these alternatives that I'm speaking about as an effective alternative to money bail. So there's been some great study and kind of analysis about how we can invest in some of these reforms, which will decrease pretrial detention and the millions of dollars that we spend operating our county jail statewide and improve outcomes in cases. Because we know when individuals are released pretrial and they're able to maintain their employment, provide for their families, maintain their housing, work with their attorneys on their cases or prepare their case for trial, that, you know, I can speak anecdotally as a defender, I would say 9.9 out of 10 times you can obtain a better outcome for that individual. And if it's their mental health or substance abuse services that may be helpful, those obviously aren't available inside the jail, and individuals can remain, you know, safely in the community and get those supports, and that really can have a significant impact in the outcome of the case.
So in Illinois, the argument was that, and in fact, this is actually the headline of the New York Times story. Let me just read that to you. Illinois becomes the first state to eliminate cash bail. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a law that would end a system that disproportionately hurts poor and favors wealthier defendants. So is the ultimate goal here to do what Illinois did, to eliminate cash bail in Washington State?
I would say that the ultimate goal, at least for us, is to significantly reduce and eliminate pretrial detention so that presumption of release is meaningful and actually occurs in practice. And so that people are not held in jail on money bail that they can't afford to pay, but they are released into the community while their case is pending for all the reasons that we have discussed today.
Right.
So I slightly reframe. So it's not just about ending cash bail. It's about looking at pretrial detention and jail rates. So that's one of the things that Illinois, their law isn't going to go into effect for 2 years, I believe. And one of the important things that they need to do is be investing also, as we're trying to do here in Washington, in those least restrictive alternatives and community-based alternatives to incarceration. So we'll be closely kind of monitoring their incarceration rates for the pretrial population, and are they actually releasing more people into the community and getting improved outcomes in criminal cases.
We're talking now with Jamie Hawk, the Legal Strategies Director of the ACLU Smart Justice Campaign, ACLU of Washington, that is. So let me step back from this and sort of look at things collectively. If you were to sit down with maybe with one of our listeners, there's obviously listeners who are very much in favor of criminal justice reform, and obviously we have listeners who maybe are not as, or they're interested in it, but they don't feel as if maybe it's worrying as much about them as it is about defendants. But I would say, if you look at things collectively, I mean, right now we had a Supreme Court decision regarding personal possession of drugs and making it very difficult sort of to find the level of intent, and that level of intent meaning that you can actually be busted for carrying drugs. We've got another bit of legislation moving through on felons being allowed to vote again. As soon as they've served their sentence, that's it. Now you have your right to vote come back. Other criminal justice reforms. Do you feel like any need to? Do you think that it makes sense that some people feel like the system is now, you know, and with say no pretrial detention and no cash bail? Do you feel like some people might see these things collectively and feel a little bit worried about where the criminal justice system is going, or do you feel like they should be encouraged by where it's going?
They should be encouraged. These examples that you just raised, and I'm doing a lot of work on that issue of voting rights restoration as well. It is such an important issue to improve reentry and civic reintegration and allow folks to have their right to vote restored when they're back in the community. And many of these reforms that you highlight are important ways to try to restore and build trust in our legal system by those who are often most marginalized and left behind. And these are just really important ways to reduce racial disparities as well on behalf of those who are indigent and, you know, as I mentioned, just real often struggling and left behind, particularly in this pandemic with the economic hardship and lack of employment and other opportunities for folks. And so, you know, these are long needed reforms to make our system more just and more fair.
And what about the people? Let's just say you're a person out there who has had some interaction with somebody who has now been arrested for something involving that interaction, and you personally feel you're a victim. You're a potential victim if this person is convicted. You're a potential victim of this crime done by this person, and maybe you get a little bit of relief or feel a little bit safer as a result of somebody being held, even though this is a pretrial hold, and even though maybe the only reason they're in jail is because they just couldn't make bail. What do you say to somebody like that who is actually feeling like, wait a minute, kicking these people back out while understanding that it is pretrial and no one's been, you know, you're presumed innocent? There still is a number of people who might feel a little safer as a result of knowing that someone is being held. Does that make sense?
You know, we want to build a system that is the most just and fair and works for all of us. And so imagine if it was your son or daughter or your husband or wife or loved one who was arrested and accused of a crime. How would you want them to be treated? And while the case was pending and they were working with their lawyer to try to get justice and defend themselves or present mitigation to explain the circumstances, what happened, you know, how would you want them to be treated? And that's, you know, the reason our legal system is based on this presumption of innocence, and that there is a presumption of release in our law in Washington, is because of those reasons. And so, you know, when people are in the community, they are, you know, we've talked about all those harms of being locked up in jail and all the ways that people suffer and that pressure to plead guilty. And would you want that for your loved one, unable to afford bail and to get out? And so that's, you know, I think what I would encourage folks to really think about and how our system should really operate and impact people. And so, you know, this is why we are, you know, advancing these alternatives and really trying to raise awareness about the harms of pretrial detention and why these reforms are so necessary.
That is Jamie Hawk. She's a legal strategies director for the ACLU of Washington. It's Smart Justice Campaign. Jamie, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Thanks so much for having me.
More to come on Cairo Nights right after this message. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. This is a bit of legislation. We're talking a lot about bills in Washington. They're all moving through kind of quickly. Some of them are really, really important. Hannah brought up from police accountability to felons getting their right to vote back. And this one, wow, this one is going to be, I imagine that some of you listening are going to be pretty unhappy about this. There's probably going to be some of you listening who are happy about this, and maybe a few of other you, well, I don't know. I'm pretty happy about this, generally speaking. I mean, to be completely honest, I don't know that I see a strong need for this particular thing, but let's talk about it first, and then we can get into the reasons why. Joseph O'Sullivan's story in the Seattle Times. This is the top of his story. After an emotional debate that highlighted and lamented America's sharp political divisions, the Washington State has voted to ban open carry of firearms and other weapons, not just at the state capitol and campuses, but at permitted demonstrations in public spaces around the state. This was Senate Bill 5038. It came after months of protest around the state over the killing of people by law enforcement, as well as demonstrations supportive of former President Donald Trump in the wake of his election defeat. So here's where we're at. You saw the protest pictures the same way I did. Maybe you even attended some. Maybe you attended some as an open carry person, and maybe you attended some supporting that but not carrying, and maybe you attended some as counter-protest, or vice versa. You showed up as open carry to protest or to counter-protest some Black Lives Matter event or an Antifa event, whatever. It's none of it is important. But I will say this. I understand why people are defenders of the Second Amendment. I was out at the shooting range in Bellevue just 2 weekends ago. Had a great time. Shot my friend's AR-15, which I had only shot one before. It was a pretty spectacular weapon. But I will say that I don't have a problem with gun controls. I do actually think that guns should be legal. I don't have a problem with people tracking them. I don't have a problem with people asking for background checks, extensive ones. I think that the liability of an impulse decision with a gun means, and no different than with a car, means that you need to have plenty of ID before having one. And that's just my opinion. But it doesn't mean that I don't think that they should exist. I'm not terribly worried about government tracking, given the tracking device that I carry in my pocket every day. But you get my drift, and you don't need to hear me preach about that. I'm not changing any minds here. I'm just telling you where I'm at. But where I'm at also is that I do feel like if people show up with any sort of weapon, I'm not talking about handguns. I'm talking about bats. I'm talking about broomsticks. I'm talking about anything that is not clearly a sign. And yes, I know people can repurpose signs into something else. But generally speaking, something that is not a sign at a protest and actually is some form of a weapon, I don't think that they should be there. Not handguns, not anything. You can go there, you can make your placards, you can chant, you can say your piece. As long as you're not throwing punches, as long as you are not doing anything to hurt anyone else, and honestly, I gotta say, as long as you quit with all the window breaking and all of that sort of garbage that happens as well, and you're there to protest, you know, I'll even concede the folks who tie up traffic doing it. I don't like it. I've been tied up in traffic a dozen times with that. I get it, and I get irritated when I'm there. And I also don't think it's, you know, especially if it's an arterial where you need to have fire and ambulance moving through, it actually does have a measure of danger. But setting that aside, I understand that the need and the requirement for public protests. I understand that it brings out more people, that it brings out attention to whatever your cause is, be it a cause considered, you know, relatively considered associated with conservatives, cause that relatively assisted, considered associative with liberals, whichever, or somewhere in the middle. But I don't ever see the idea of bringing a weapon of any sort, regardless of whether it's constitutionally protected or your just personal desire. I don't see the value in bringing that in, because it seems to me like that is a measure of provocation in itself. And I'm not talking just about handguns or long guns. I'm talking about the people who walk up. Well, I've seen people walk up with bats. I've seen people walk up with pipes. I've seen people walk up with those things because other people have walked up with guns. I've seen all of that stuff, having covered protests for years at news organizations. And I've never seen in any situation somebody that whole event of carrying something in become de-escalate anything. Now, is there somebody with a pipe who may not hit somebody with a gun because they're worried about the gun? Yeah, I'll concede that point. But did that person with a pipe, are they agitated when they see someone with a gun? Yeah, probably. And is someone with a gun more likely to pull it and use it in a situation where maybe they might have, I don't know, not done that, or maybe just defended themselves and moved along or moved out of there? And I get it. There are threatening things. But honestly, having been to as many protests as I've been, a lot of times the people who get into trouble are the people who are there looking for it. And I'm not, you know, or the people who decide that they are going to be the one to explain to everyone what's what from an inch away from their face. So this sort of thing, and I know that there's a whole bunch of people out there, and maybe you don't like what I have to say, and I'm sorry about that, because probably personally we could have a beer together and maybe get along. But I don't see, when I've been out to these protests and I've seen people carrying any weapon whatsoever or anything that could be repurposed immediately as a weapon. Let's just say you claim you're heading home from baseball practice and you got a bat with you. You know, I don't buy it any more than anyone else does. I do think that those sort of things do nothing toward advancing your political point, defying someone else's political point, and getting to a place where you're having your right to protest, your constitutionally protected right to protest, and still being heard at that point, because no one's actually hearing anything. What they're doing is they're seeing the weapon. That's what they're doing. And they're judging you and the rest of the protest by it. And I don't know that I've ever seen that effective in any manner at any protest that I've been to. But, you know, just one man's thinking. So now it is going to be illegal. Is this going to be challenged in court? And remember, that's, if you want to look it up, that's Senate Bill 5038. Is it going to be challenged in court? Zero question. This is going to be the type of bill that is going to be a lightning rod across the country. It's going to be a rallying point. My guess is the NRA, which I think declared bankruptcy in New York, but is moving to another state, probably a friendlier one. My guess is that there will be a lawsuit or a challenge of some sort. The Pacific Legal Foundation or the NRA or something along those lines is going to step up and say, hey, we feel that this is we feel this is constitutionally protected. And I've got to say, I'm interested in seeing what they do, and I'm interested in seeing the lawsuit. And it could be that a court will find that it is. It doesn't seem to me that you can't still get the same effective protest by not carrying those things in. But nonetheless, I mean, I'll abide by whatever the courts say in that regard. But I got to say, I think that this is actually a move forward for all sides, regardless of political persuasion and regardless of your feelings about the Second Amendment. I think that this de-escalates situations considerably. And I think that the de-escalation is the way we can actually start getting to a place where we can talk to each other again. Again, one man's opinion, right? Up next on Cairo Nights, the random question robot. Last time for the week that we have to go through this. Hopefully we'll do a little better than we did earlier in the week. That is right after the break. Please stay tuned. All right, folks, it's last crack at us, our last crack at it. It's the random question robot, Questron 700. here to ask us questions that we will endeavor to answer. Frank is ready. He's got that look in his eye. Shane has got that look in his eye, which can mean just about anything.
Yeah.
Let's go.
All right. Let's see what we got here. All right, this one is for Mr. Frank. Frank.
Yes, sir.
Who knows you best?
Oh, well, my wife, I would say. I mean, yeah, I mean, they're, well, may, okay, that's not fair. No, it is fair. My wife knows me best. My sister.
Well, clearly Frank doesn't know Frank best. I'd say that much.
Okay, my wife knows me best. My sister thinks she knows me best, but my wife knows me.
Okay, fair answer. Mike?
That's a really good question. I would say it the name changes depending on the time of my life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say that Mary, my partner now, knows me really, really well. But I would say, you know, if you were to ask individuals from really, really pivotal points in my life who I was hanging around with the most at that particular point. So it could be a family member. I've got a couple of good, close friends who probably know me really, really well, certainly know my tendencies. So I don't know. I don't know that I could pin that down to any one person.
I'm having trouble answering this question, too, because part of me wants to say my mom, because I have a very good relationship with my mom. I share a lot of stuff with her. But I think probably the person who I share the most with is my buddy Connor, who I went to high school with. He followed me up to Central Washington. He works for Amazon now, and he's still in the area. And I've spent more time with him in my time up here in Washington than most anybody else, just because we're friends and the familiarity.
Makes sense.
So, I mean, all the time that I've spent with him, I would say, you know, I'd say my boy Kana knows me best.
Fair enough.
The Jersey Devil. All right, let's see what else we got. All right, Mike, this question is for you. This is an interesting one. Name an album that you wish that you were present for when they recorded it.
Nebraska by Bruce Springsteen.
Huh.
Mainly because he did that as a demo on a 4-track in a bedroom. And then took it to a studio and never got it better and went back to the original 4-track he did by himself and released it like that. Which is a desert island disc for me. I think it is a spectacular album, mainly because it's got that perfect kind of lonely sound because it's one guy and a guitar.
Yeah.
All right. Frank?
Abbey Road. I would like to go back when the Beatles recorded that and just... I mean, Here Comes the Sun, right?
Amazing.
I would love to see those songs produced. Plus, George Martin, the only man that ever produced the Beatles' music, was probably, in my humble opinion, one of the greatest audio producers ever, and I would have liked to have seen him work.
And I've got a backup one as well, but go ahead.
Oh, this one's really hard for me. So I'm just going to throw two quick answers. I'm going to say Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys.
Good choice.
Just because I think just...
Genius album.
Absolutely genius. Brian Wilson and everybody in the Beach Boys, their music's absolutely amazing. And I took a rock and roll history class, and learning about that album got me juiced up.
Speaking of such, it's the album that, by the Beatles' own estimation, that inspired Sgt. Pepper's.
Oh,
it is.
Gorgeous. Well, the other album that I have, newer artist. His name's Mac DeMarco. He's a kind of an indie artist out of Canada. His album, Mac DeMarco 2, he recorded every single instrument on the whole entire album in his studio apartment, and he made it a point to record it every single song in his underwear, just completely in his underwear.
I would love to see
the creative genius of just that and the hilarity.
Technically,
of it.
Everyone we've talked about was wearing their underwear. I'm assuming when they
but
were so.
Apparently,
you mean only.
Yes, only. Yes.
I would have said on the other end of the spectrum, hanging out with Dr. Dre and Snoop for The Chronic would have been just from a party standpoint.
Still be
I think it would have been a pretty epic story. What I would remembered, I would never forget.
What little you could remember.
I'm kind of upset. You topped me up. That's a way better album than both of my choices. All right, let's see here. Yeah, we got one more here. Okay, this is a good one. This is a radio question, actually.
Okay.
What two radio stations do you listen to in your car most? Me? Obviously.
Kyro. Everyone here is getting a paycheck.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Yeah. I listen to Kyro 97.3
that
FM.
That sounds like such a setup.
What's the second?
Well, I originally wanted to just ask, but the robot said two. So I'm going to just, obviously we all listen to Kyro, but I'm a big KISW guy. The Rock has a lot of history, and I think that place is awesome. So The Rock for me.
So I guess my two would be, as required, Kyro Radio, 97.3 FM.
And
KBCS. I think KBCS out of Bellevue is a phenomenal station, and it's got a lousy signal. I mean, you can catch it on streaming, but really some of the better programming around. And I know everyone loves KXP, but give them a listen, too.
Okay, right on. Frank?
I'm going to be mundane and say, obviously, Kyro Radio, 97.3 FM, but then also our sister station, KTTH, because I kind of bounce back and forth between different talk shows. Mm-hmm. So I'll be listening to Tom and Curly, and then I'll bounce over to that guy that's on in the afternoon at KTTH, who will remain nameless. And, you know, I'm very content to do that.
All right. Well, this is all that we got
that
tonight.
All right, folks. Thanks again for joining us, Random Question Robot. We survived another round. We will be back with you on Monday for another round. In the next hour, we've got – it's going to be great. Stacey and I are going to chat about not so much the Russell Wilson stuff. Well, all right, we will. But we're also going to talk about its context in sports history and becoming a free agent. It's actually a pretty great conversation coming up.